reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on Monday said the United States is looking into allegations of human rights abuses by Israel in its operation against Hamas in Gaza.
From day one, we've been working to do everything we can to try to increase protection for civilians, as well as, you know, to facilitate the delivery of humanitarian assistance for the Gazans who so desperately need it.
Axios News site on Saturday reported Washington was planning to impose sanctions on Israeli battalion, which has operated in the occupied West Bank, though the Israeli military said it was not aware of any such measures. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said on Sunday he would fight against sanctions being imposed on any Israeli military units for alleged rights violations after media reports said Washington was planning such a step. Israel has yet to provide evidence for its accusations that hundreds of staff with the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, or UNRWA, are members of terrorist groups, according to a new review of the agency's neutrality released on Monday that could prompt some donor countries to review funding freezes, Reuters' Rachel Faber reports.
The review also noted that UNRWA has a, quote, more developed approach to neutrality than other similar UN or aid groups. According to Catherine Colonna, a former French foreign minister appointed by the UN to lead the review.
There's always room for improvement. And some issues related to neutrality persist. This is why this mission was created.
Colonna was tasked with the review after Israel accused 12 UNRWA staff of taking part in the Hamas-led October 7th attacks that triggered the Gaza war. A separate probe by internal UN investigators is looking into those allegations.
Reuters' Rachel Faber. Gaza hospital officials say an Israeli airstrike on a home in the territory's southernmost city of Rafah has killed at least 9 people, 6 of them children. This is VOA News. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has supervised salvo launches of the country's super-large multiple rocket launchers that simulated a nuclear counterattack against enemy targets, according to state media Tuesday, adding to testing activities and threats that have raised tensions in the region. The report by North Korea's official Korean Central News Agency came a day after the South Korean and Japanese militaries detected the North firing what they suspected as multiple short-range ballistic missiles from a region near its capital, Pyongyang, towards its eastern seas. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is headed to China this week for talks with senior officials in Shanghai and Beijing to discuss a range of issues, including Russia's war against Ukraine, the Middle East crisis, the South China Sea, and human rights. VOA's Nike Ching has more.
Blinken has also spoken out on China's support for Russia in its war with Ukraine. The United States, together with other nations in the Group of Seven, has urged China to stop transferring dual-use materials and weapons components that Russia is using to advance its military production. The U.S. said it is prepared to take further steps as necessary, but Beijing has dismissed Washington's concerns. Nike Chin, VOA News, Washington.
A New York jury heard opening statements Monday, the first day of Donald Trump's criminal hush money trial. Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner with more.
Prosecutors said the former president broke the law and deceived voters in the 2016 election by trying to cover up sexual encounters with adult film actress Stormy Daniels and Playboy model Karen McDougal. Trump's defense attorney told the jury that his client committed no crime, adding, quote, "There's nothing wrong with trying to influence an election. It's called democracy." Trump is charged with falsifying business records to cover up a $130,000 payment to Daniels in 2016 to keep quiet about a sexual encounter she says they had 10 years earlier.
Reuters' Freddie Joyner. A Peruvian psychologist who suffered from an incurable disease that weakened her muscles and had her confined to her bed for several years died by euthanasia, becoming the first person in the country to obtain the right to die with medical assistance. Ana Estrada fought for years in Peruvian courts for the right to die with dignity and became a celebrity in the conservative country where euthanasia and assisted suicide are illegal. In 2022, Estrada was granted an exception by the nation's Supreme Court, which upheld a ruling by a lower court that gave her the right to decide when to end her life and said that those who helped her would not be punished. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The Connect Africa Summit in Kenya addresses the continent's challenges, opportunities, and bridging digital divides.
Africa's digital economy has immense potential. Our youth population is motivated and prepared to drive the digital economy, foster innovation, and entrench new technologies.
Zimbabwe authorities apprehend illicit money changers. A U.S. charity trains medics to improve healthcare in rural Kenya. Ghana's civil society groups join anti-corruption fight. South Africa's Umkhonto we Sizwe party wins another court victory against the ruling ANC.
It means that we are now heading to elections, so definitely sure we are going to achieve this 2/3 majority come 29th of May.
And U.S. presidential contenders differ on who's better for the economy. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Government representatives from Africa, along with ICT officials and international organizations, have gathered in Nairobi for the Connect Africa Summit. They are discussing the future of technology, unlocking the continent's growth beyond connectivity, and addressing the challenges and opportunities of the continent's information and technology sector. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
Speaking at the Connected Africa Summit opening in Nairobi Monday, Kenyan President William Ruto said bridging the technology gap is important for Africa's economic growth and innovation.
Crossing the digital divide is a priority in terms of enhancing connectivity, expanding the contribution of ICT sector to Africa's GDP, and driving overall GDP growth across all sectors. Africa's digital economy has immense potential. Our youth population, the youngest globally, is motivated and prepared to drive the digital economy, foster innovation, and entrench new technologies.
Experts say digital transformation in Africa can improve its industrialization, reduce poverty, create jobs, and improve its citizens' lives. According to the World Bank, 36% of Africa's 1.3 billion population have access to the internet, and in some of the areas that have connections, the quality of the service is poor compared to other regions. The International Financial Institution figures show that Africa saw a 115% increase in internet usage between 2016 and 2021, and that 160 million gained broadband internet access between 2019 and 2022. Africa's digital growth has been hampered by the lack of an accessible, secure and reliable internet, which is critical in closing the digital gap and reducing inequalities. Lesina Kone is the head of Smart Africa, an organization that coordinates ICT activities within the continent. He says integrating technology into African society's daily activities is necessary and cannot be ignored.
Digital transformation is no longer a choice. It's a necessity, just like a water utility, just like any other utility that we use at home. So this Connected Africa is an opportunity for all of us. I see that a lot of our country members, ICT ministers, are here to actually align our visions together.
The COVID-19 pandemic has accelerated the consumption of technology in different sectors of the African economy. And experts say opportunities now exist in mobile services, the development of broadband infrastructure, and data storage. The U.S. Ambassador to Kenya, Meg Whitman, called on the summit attendees to develop technologies that can solve people's problems.
I encourage all of you to consider this approach for your economies. Look at what strengths already exist in your countries and ask how technology can solve challenges in those sectors to make you a leader through innovation. Sometimes innovation looks like artificial intelligence and satellites and e-money. Sometimes, though, it looks much different than we expect. However, innovation always includes three elements: solutions-focused, it is specific, and it's sustainable. Being solution-focused is the foundation of shaping the future of a connected Africa.
The summit ends on Friday, but before that, those attending aim to explore ways to improve Africa's technology usage, enhance continental connectivity, boost competitiveness, and ensure the continent keeps up with the ever-evolving tech sector. Mohammed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
In South Africa, a spokesperson for the opposition Umkhonto we Sizwe, or MK party, says the group has stepped up its campaign ahead of the May 29th national elections. Noma Buthelezi says the opposition party is determined to win a two-thirds majority in parliament to form the next government. Her comments come after a KwaZulu-Natal High Court in Durban rejected a petition by the African National Congress to prevent the MK from using a logo that the ANC argues is its asset and heritage. Noma Buthelezi tells viewers Peter Clotty that the Umkhonto we Sizwe party is happy with the court's decision.
Not a surprise, as we knew that this judgment was going to be in our favor because there was actually no case. You know, the opposition party is also trying to make themselves relevant again. But we are very much excited, but it's nothing that we weren't expecting. We expected the results. So, but we are happy, we are happy.
What does this mean for the Umkhonto we Sizwe party, this victory? What does it mean for you?
It means that we are now heading to elections, so definitely sure we are going to achieve this two or third majority come 29th of May. So now we are back on the grounds as we were already on the grounds since the MK party was launched on the 16th of December. So we are going back to the grounds again, going back to the people again, campaigning more and more to reach our targets for the elections.
Well, according to the ANC, your party's logo is a heritage and an asset, and basically you are infringing on its right. Supporters of the ANC are saying that is not fair, and perhaps they should appeal the ruling. What do you say to that?
They can appeal. It's fine. I think now they are just wasting their time. They should be busy campaigning as well, but they are busy with court cases, of which all of them, they are losing them. So to us, it's fine. They can go and appeal. We'll be ready for them again.
So with this logo firmly in your hands officially, what's next for the Umkhonto we Sizwe party ahead of the coming May elections?
What is next for Umkhonto we Sizwe party from now on is to launch more and more of campaigns. We have our programs, or we have the programs that we have on our POAs as the Umkhonto we Sizwe party, as the Umkhonto we Sizwe youth league, as the Umkhonto we Sizwe women's league. So all our campaigns are now for us as leadership and our forces, our masses, to go back to the ground, to go back to the people and tell them more about Umkhonto we Sizwe party. So for now, we are heading back. We are heading to elections. We don't have time. I think we are left with 36 or 37 days now. So that's the only time we left for us to campaign more.
The latest opinion polls show that Umkhonto we Sizwe party has garnered 15%, basically taking away support from the African National Congress. But you are claiming that you are going to form a two-thirds majority. What makes you so confident?
You know, we have membership. So it's the membership that we have at the moment, the membership that we signed on the Umkhonto we Sizwe online registration, the membership that the people of Umkhonto we Sizwe are signing manually, and the membership that hasn't already been signed, members of the Umkhonto we Sizwe party.
But the ANC is doing the same. So far, although it's unable, according to the statistics, unable to achieve the 50% mark, it has the largest support across the country.
Let us wait and see after the 29th of May, how is it going to go?
How are people reacting to your new party?
They are very happy. You know, Umkhonto we Sizwe party is not funded by anyone, but it's funded by its people.
Noma Buthelezi is the spokesperson for the opposition Umkhonto we Sizwe party of South Africa. She was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. Zimbabwean authorities responded swiftly to the recent decline in the new gold-backed currency by apprehending illicit money changers and closing the bank accounts of business accused of exclusively dealing in U.S. dollars. Business argue that this approach is not sustainable. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
On Monday, Zimbabwe business owners pleaded with parliamentary committees to ask the government to stop arresting money changers and reopen the bank accounts of companies accused of only accepting foreign currency. Sekai Kuvarika is the chief executive officer of the Confederation of Zimbabwe Industries.
So we believe that looking at the impact that the policies had over the past couple of weeks and continuing to address any blind spots, any unintended impacts, this is an inception process of a monetary policy shift. Let's give ourselves time. Let's give the markets time. Let's give the policymakers time to iterate how the policy is going to work in our markets. But we definitely do not support that we accompany our policies with the police. The policy should be superior to the police.
Last week, police arrested several people it said were fueling the black market, where Zimbabwe's new currency called ZiG, introduced earlier this month, is trading at around 20 ZiG for $1. The government's official exchange rate is 13 ZiG to $1. Owen Maverenge with the Institute of Chartered Accountants of Zimbabwe says arresting money changers causes panic.
The power market and those dealers in the street are a symptom of the problem. So sending the police doesn't really inspire confidence. So we try to have the situation really end with a good cause. And in this sort of approach, the policies will speak, particularly the ones we were talking about, the actual roadmap to de-dollarize, starting with the government and government-related services. There must be a deliberate effort to make sure that the government starts to take its view.
The government says for now, commodities like fuel and import duties will still be paid with US dollars. Parliament had summoned Finance Minister Muturi Ncube and Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe Governor Johnny Mshabane to explain how the ZiG current rollout would work, but for unspecified reasons, neither attended. Last week, Mshabane announced a shift in the central bank's policies, vowing to restore confidence in an institution which has failed to stabilize the nation's currents. Ngonidzashe Mudekunye, chairman of Parliament's Industry and Commerce Committee, said he was happy to hear business owners about the new currents.
We want to get feedback regarding the new policy, whether it's working, whether the industry has new suggestions that might be helpful to ensure that this new monetary policy works. We all want a stable currency. Everyone is crying for it. We get so many views. The market wants a stable currency. This is what we are going to suggest to them.
The next stage for ZiG, introducing physical notes and coins to the public, is set for April 13. Columbus Mafunga, VOA News, Mount Hamden, Zimbabwe.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty, Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 23rd. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Experts say one of the healthcare challenges in Africa is a shortage of training and education for workers. To help, a U.S. charity called Mission to Heal is training local workers who serve patients in remote locations. Juma Majanga reports from Ngurunrinit village in northern Kenya.
It's a beehive of activity at Ngurunrinit Health Center in a remote village in the dry Marsabit County in northern Kenya. Residents have gathered here, some traveling tens of kilometers to seek medical services. On this day, the U.S. medical charity Mission to Heal is providing more advanced medical equipment and training local medical workers to use it.
We take the experts that live here and we bring them in there and show them how it is that we can do things and get the principles without the plumbing. Taking care of the people in the context of their culture and their family setting is something that's going to happen here.
Mission to Heal founder Dr. Glenn Gilhod says their goal is to empower local caregivers with knowledge and skills to improve medical services in remote locations like this.
How do you tie the last knot?
Meshek Lekeda is a local nurse at the Ngurunrinit Health Center.
They've even taught me how to manage some new conditions here and there that I never knew before. And they're even equipping with the equipment. Right?
A 2019 report by the U.S. National Institute of Health found that a key problem facing the healthcare in Africa is weak training and education of workers. Kristen Alcorn, a volunteer, says Mission to Heal can help.
They have the knowledge, but their resources are limited. And so I think that we can help them try to best manage things and come up with diagnoses and come up with the best possible diagnosis and treatment with their limited resources.
Senahia Kalaili traveled over 30 kilometers to seek treatment. She came here in a lot of pain, especially in her abdomen. The doctors checked and gave her 2 injections and some medicines, and now she feels better, she says. The pain has gone down, she adds. Volunteer medical students say they are learning too. Abby Winkelmann is a medical student from the U.S.
Obviously, the culture is very different and the resources are very different. So there's been a steep learning curve in terms of figuring out what we can do and really what we should do.
Wilhelmine Poon is a medical student at the University of Amsterdam.
For me, a big thing was like using gloves for the second time. Back home, we use the gloves and we toss them. It's not like normal to use it the second time. And they do with everything.
The UN Development Program says some 408 million people in sub-Saharan Africa still don't have healthcare. Mission to Heal says it has trained 3,200 healthcare workers on the continent. Juma Majanga, VOA News, Gurunet Village, Kenya.
According to a 2023 Transparency International report, most African nations are showing stagnation or failing to make progress against corruption, which is still a reality in many African countries, including Ghana. According to the Ghana Commission on Human Rights and Administration Services Justice, also known as CHRAJ, corruption accounts for about 20% of the national budget. Civil society groups are joining the fight, taken up the challenge to expose it and push everyone for action. Isaac Alije has more from Accra.
These Ghanaian journalists are planning for their next big investigative story. They work for the Fourth Estate, an Accra-based non-profit public interest and accountability initiative by the Media Foundation for West Africa. The editor is Kofi Enchil.
We work with Ghanaians, we work with whistleblowers who give us information. And so we look at issues and we go deep into those issues. We bring them out in forms of, you know, publications, online, you know, write-ups and YouTube videos and all that, mainstream documentaries.
The publications focuses largely on anti-corruption related stories. Since launching in 2021, it has published several groundbreaking anti-graft stories. Among them was an exposé by the project on asset declaration following a requirement that government officials declare their assets. The Fourth Estate filed the case with Ghana's Commission on Human Rights and Administrative Justice that further investigated the matter.
So when we did that story, as many as 294 or so public officials hurriedly declared their assets. In fact, before the publication, they are not, but they were in office. But when we published the story, very quickly, they declared their assets. And we thought that that was impactful and it sent the right message to authorities and to public officials.
Anti-corruption campaigners say fighting corruption in Ghana has become a daunting task, despite the country launching the National Anti-Corruption Action Plan, a policy document with plans to combat corruption. Mary Ada is the executive director of Ghana Integrity Initiative.
The National Anti-Corruption Action Plan was the blueprint for all of us to fight corruption. However, in all these very glowing attributes that I give, you would realize that there are so many gaps within the system that we haven't paid attention to. And for that matter, it makes the fight against corruption a difficult one.
Some of those gaps include weak laws that hinder the work of state institutions mandated to investigate and prosecute corrupt public officials. Civil society groups like the Center for Democratic Development, CDD, are filling the gap and taking on the challenge. In 2017, the organization launched the Corruption Watch Project in an attempt to reduce public corruption through advocacy for transparency. The activism by the CDD team for the past 7 years appears to be yielding results. Thanks to the works of these civil society groups, the fight against corruption is on people's mind. Isaac Kalaji, VOA News, Accra.
The United States has begun discussions with Niger on withdrawing the more than 1,000 American personnel in the military-ruled country, which has been a key base for regional counterterrorism operations, officials said on Monday. Niger's military government said in March that it was ending a military cooperation agreement with Washington, which agreed to remove its troops last week and said it would send a delegation to Niamey within days. The U.S. economy is always a major factor in the presidential campaign because the president plays a key role in setting and shaping trade and economic policies. VOA's senior Washington correspondent Caroline Presutti reports on how the economy is doing and the difference between how the two presidential contenders would handle it.
President Joe Biden grew up in this house, in a working-class neighborhood in a northeastern U.S. town. Using his background, Biden this week cast former President Donald Trump as out of touch.
He looks at the economy from Mar-a-Lago, where he and his rich friends embraced the failed trickle-down policies that have failed working families for more than 40 years. Scranton values or Mar-a-Lago values. These are the competing visions for our economy, and they raise questions of fundamental fairness to the heart of this campaign.
During the beginning of Trump's term, the economy was strong, with unemployment at 3.5%. Dee Bovaer is a Trump supporter in New Hampshire.
Everybody was happy. Everybody was making money. Everybody was good.
But then COVID. In Trump's final year, unemployment shot up to 14.7%. Last month's unemployment rate was back down to 3.8%. Howard Webster is a Biden supporter in Arizona.
And what Joe Biden has done for the economy, it's the best economy we've had, lowest unemployment.
Critics labeled President Biden's approach as Bidenomics, but Biden embraced the term and said it was helping regular Americans.
I see an America where the economy grows from the middle out and the bottom up. And that way the middle class does well and the poor have a shot.
But many agree inflation remains too high, even though it has fallen from a peak in 2022 to around 3.5% now. Voters still blame Biden. So does former President Trump.
We have to explain to the American people what the hell is going on, because they're looking at the border and they're looking at inflation and they're looking at the economy, which is terrible.
As president, Donald Trump's policies largely favored American-made products. He continues that in his campaign, here talking about Mexican-made cars.
We're going to put a 100% tariff on every single car that comes across the line, and you're not going to be able to sell those guys.
This week's Reuters poll indicates that Americans believe Trump would handle the economy better than the current president. Caroline Presutti, VOA News.
And that's it for this Tuesday, April 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butte, Washington, wishing that you will have an amazing Tuesday.
Like their neurotypical peers, women with autism can learn to live independently, build career, start a business, and more. However, understanding their needs is key to their success. On this week's edition of Our Voices, we will discuss what success means as autistic women and where it should start. Join the conversation on Wednesdays at